Good evening. It's Sunday, July 18th, 2021. Coming up, as Democrats call for marijuana reform that includes federal legalization and expungement of nonviolent cannabis convictions, some are questioning the Olympic Committee's marijuana policies, given that it's not a performance-enhancing drug.
I do think the Olympic Committee is behind the curve on this.
After a long quarantine period, many Americans are getting back into the groove this summer with festivals and music. Gangsta Grass says they're trying to get people to find common ground, even in pandemic times.
The assumption that, oh, these country music white guys and these hip-hop black guys wouldn't find common ground. They wouldn't be doing things together. And I think that whole conception of who we are as a country is underpinning our politics in such a negative way. And that's what we are here to challenge.
And as many people are advocating for prison reform, they're also considering how to work around those who believe that prison should merely be about punishment.
You know, there are these reforms that are very general that would have a great effect, of course, on what happens in terms of people facing prison or not.
I'm Sharon Sabota, and this is the KPFA Weekend Evening News. On Wednesday, Senators Cory Booker, Chuck Schumer, and Ron Wyden released a discussion draft of legislation to reform marijuana laws and policies in the United States. The program would expunge federal nonviolent cannabis convictions and create grants to support those who have been negatively impacted by the so-called war on drugs. Meanwhile, the recent suspension of Olympic athlete Sha'Carri Richardson, who was put on a month's... who tested positive for marijuana, has many people questioning the policies of the Olympic Committee regarding marijuana, given that it's not a performance-enhancing drug and is widely legal. Cynthia Gannot is a gender and race sociologist from the University of Louisville. Gannot called Richardson's suspension heartbreaking and unnecessary.
She learned in an interview through a reporter in the press that her biological mother had passed. She then, as a way to cope, as she explains it, smoked some marijuana, was heartbroken and sideswiped and absolutely taken off her game is 2 or 3 days before the biggest race of her life. And so she says, you know, she did it to cope. She takes responsibility. She says, I'm human. I knew it wasn't something I should be doing. However, a lot of people have said, this then begs the question, should it even be on the list of banned substances?
Just as many states have amended their laws around marijuana, Gannot says it's time for the Olympic Committee to revisit its policies as well.
I do think the Olympic Committee is behind the curve on this. Do things like marijuana use that have absolutely no performance enhancement aspect, should they even be on this list? They were included originally as a quote unquote, one of the substances that is detrimental to society. Many, many states have actually made different decisions about marijuana in that time period. There's a great question about whether marijuana should be removed from the banned substances list. And this leaves a young woman who stood to gain millions in endorsements from the Olympics, from a very impoverished family. This leaves her because of one quote unquote mistake. She has literally lost millions by not being able to compete in the 100 and then not being chosen for the Olympic relay team.
That's Cynthia Gannot, a gender sociologist from the University of Louisville. The Ethiopian government has been engaged in a civil war in its northern Tigray state since the Tigray's People Liberation Front attacked a military base in Mekelle, the capital of Tigray state, last November. Western officials have overwhelmingly blamed Ethiopia and its prime minister, Abiy Ahmed, for the war, for alleged atrocities, and for obstructing humanitarian aid convoys trying to reach the Tigrayan people. KPFA's Ann Garrison spoke to Obong Metho, who tells a different story from his home in Gambela, Ethiopia. Mr. Metho is founder and executive director of the Solitary Group for a New Ethiopia.
Obong Metho, you're speaking to us from your homeland in Gambela, Ethiopia, but for many years, you've been back and forth between Ethiopia and Washington, D.C. Is that because the United States has a lot of power regarding what happens in Ethiopia, so you need to be there where you can speak to our legislators and perhaps other officials?
Yes, I definitely think that the U.S. has lots of power, lots of influence in the world that we live in today. And so, yes, that I could say that. And also the second, that there are more Ethiopian people in DMV area, Washington, D.C., Virginia, and then Maryland. So there's more Ethiopians in there. And as also, as you say, that my work in the last 18 years was based in the U.S. and Canada. And so the advocacy work we do in the last 18 years was within the U.S. meeting with the U.S. policymakers and then the U.S.-based NGOs.
Shortly after the TPLF started the war by attacking a federal army base in the middle of the night, Western media began reporting that Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed started the war by attacking Tigray. Can you confirm that the TPLF started the war?
I would definitely say it based on what I heard from the people, not even from the government. I even talked to some people from my own ethnic group from Gambela who were in that place where the, you know, the Northern Command center was attacked. He was one of the individual, a young man who survived, and he told me he was eyewitness. Yes, that the TPLF did attack the base and killing some of their colleagues, and they did that, and then Abiy respond to that. So which is in any countries, you know, that the, for example, the U.S.
Wait a second, let me ask. Your friend from there in Gambela?
A young man, a soldier.
He was in the army, he was at the army base that the TPLF attacked.
Yes, and he was a witness.
Did Ethiopia have a national identity before the TPLF seized power?
Definitely, Ethiopian national identity was there almost 100 years ago. When the Ethiopian fought Italian to win the Adwa, there was an Ethiopian national identity. Ethiopian has a national identity. Their national identity, their strength, their national identity, their backbone, their national identity were what kept Ethiopia to be a country. Ethiopia was a country before the U.S. was a country. So the Ethiopian national identity was there. But it was ethnocentric individuals who have no respect, leave alone for the country, even for their own self and their family and their ethnic groups. It is those ethnocentric groups who come on, took over Ethiopia, and then created this mess that we have in. They introduced this backward institutionalized political system and take away the national identity. The Ethiopianness, what they call Ethiopia, win it. Ethiopianness, that, you know, a diverse Ethiopian. Ethiopia is one of those few countries in the world where you will find a man by the name Peters, who is Imam. Ethiopia is one of those countries. You will find a Mohammed preaching in the church and then Peter in the mosque. Their church, they're divided, you know, their religion tolerance in Ethiopia. Ethiopians used to live together for 3,000 years, they intermarriage. The king used to marry other groups to keep peace. But these narrow-minded, short-sighted tribal leaders come and took away the Ethiopian national identity.
Ethiopians, including even the TPLF, seem to be united behind the Grand Ethiopian Renaissance Dam, which has the potential to generate enough electricity for all Ethiopians and even for export revenue. Do you think the ongoing development of the dam has potential to build the Ethiopian national identity that you and your organization are trying to build?
You're right. The dam is one thing that for the whole Ethiopian peoples. The dam, once it's done, it is going to give light to 65 million people, not 65 million tribes, not 65 million different, you know, one group or one ethnic group or one religious affiliation. It will be giving a light to the Ethiopian people. For sure, it's unified Ethiopian. Second, Ethiopian be known and begging money from others. These dam is not being done by the money being brought from the European Union or the USAID or other places. It's by Ethiopians themselves who funded this. So this definitely could be something that will unify the Ethiopian, will bring them back their self-worthy, their self-dignity, their Ethiopianness, which has been robbed from them by the ethno-nationalist group and their foreigner crony.
That was Obang Metho, founder and executive director of Solidarity Group for a New Ethiopia. In Berkeley, for Pacifica, KPFA Radio, I'm Ann Garrison.
The prison system in the U.S. has come in for its share of criticism for a number of reasons, including the failure to integrate prisoners back into society. Lance Tapley is an independent journalist based in Maine who's written extensively about prisons. KPFA reporter David Rosenberg asked him if it's possible to break through to people who believe prison should be about punishment and not rehabilitation.
What I have found is if you keep harping on things, if you keep saying things to the public, which means to some extent eventually to the politicians, over and over and over, often it will get the point. And we've had considerable reform in Maine, I think, because I and some other people have harped on this issue. And I and some other people have been involved nationally in terms of harping on the issue of solitary confinement on that level too. And it has resulted in at least some states. I mean, New York passed a law recently, for example, limiting solitary confinement. It's allowed some states to take a new look and to do something about it. And Connecticut, I haven't checked lately, but there was a similar law on the governor's desk that the legislature had passed, and it may have been passed by now.
What you're talking about, just kind of keep hammering away, that's what the conservatives have done in the last few decades, deregulation, privatization, free trade, they just keep pitching those ideas.
It's true, and people on the other side can hammer away at things too. Sometimes hammer away at things that need to be changed, but sometimes I think that they have the wrong target. I've noticed, for example, in our new consciousness about racism in the United States, that you can open, the New York Times Magazine or many other magazines, and you can see black models for the first time in great numbers, and that's good. But I say to myself, is that changing the economic situation for black people? For example, black families have 1/7 the wealth on average of white families. I mean, we've got to provide jobs for people, for example. That would mean a lot for prisoners. We've got to provide for people who might otherwise go in prison. We've got to provide proper mental health care. There are these reforms that are very general that would have a great effect, on what happens in terms of people facing prison or not.
That's independent journalist Lance Tapley. He spoke with KPFA's David Rosenberg. While there's a lot of attention focused on various wars going on all over the planet, there's relatively little attention given to the potential for space wars. Bruce Gagnon is the coordinator of the Global Network Against Weapons and Nuclear Power in Space. KPFA's David Rosenberg asked him why the issue doesn't get much play.
Because it's not reported by anyone other than the only place I read about it is in the industry publication, Aviation Week and Space Technology magazine. Of course, most Americans don't read that. It's not picked up by the mainstream media, I think for obvious reasons. I'll never forget during Ronald Reagan's time in office in the 80s, when he brought forward the idea of Star Wars, Strategic Defense Initiative, there was so much money pumped into that and so little technology development going on at the time because it was all new. And so these corporations had a lot of excess money. So they began buying up a lot of media, radio, television, newspaper. Weapons corporations did. And so today we see this consolidation of corporate media. So it's no coincidence that something that was reported on quite thoroughly back in the early 80s when Reagan introduced Star Wars today is basically a blank slate in the corporate media.
Would you say that what's going on now is the modern version of Star Wars, or is it really qualitatively different?
Well, it's a continuation of the vision. We have to remember that this vision's been around a long time. When the U.S. smuggled 1,500 Nazi operatives into the U.S. after World War II during Operation Paperclip, amongst them was 100 of Hitler's rocket team, Werner von Braun and his engineers and scientists, and they were brought to Huntsville, Alabama, to Redstone Arsenal to create the U.S. space program. One of the guys that came along was Major General Walter Dornberger, who was Hitler's liaison to von Braun and the rocket team. And in the 50s, he testified before the Congress of the United States, and he talked about orbiting battle stations that would give the U.S. control of the Earth below and the ability to control who could get on and off the planet to eventually go out and mine the sky. Today, we hear a lot of talk about going out and mining various planetary surfaces for various resources. And again, the nuclear industry is very excited about this because they want to put nuclear-powered mining colonies on these planetary bodies. So this vision of orbiting battle stations, Star Wars, has been around since the days. I call it the Nazi prophecy has come home to roost in the United States.
That's Bruce Gagnon of the Global Network Against Weapons and Nuclear Power in Space, speaking with KPFA's David Rosenberg. You're listening to the Weekend Evening News on KPFA 94.1 FM in Berkeley, KFCF 88.1 FM in Fresno, on K248BR 97.5 FM in Santa Cruz, and online at kpfa.org. I'm Sharon Sabota. After months of isolation and what seems like a short pause from the pandemic just as the Delta variant begins kicking in, people across the country are getting reacquainted with the age-old summer traditions of gatherings, festivals, and music in park. I caught up with members of the group Gangstagrass in Stevens Point, Wisconsin, where they played in front of thousands of people for the city's Independence Day celebration, just days after they appeared on America's Got Talent and got unanimous yeses.
I'm Wrench. I play guitar and sing, and I make beats.
My name is Dan Whitener. They call me Danjo because I play banjo, and I sing, and I write some of the songs.
I'm Dolio the Sleuth. I'm an MC, and I'm also a vocalist.
Dale Arson, the voice of reason, MC extraordinaire. And
my name is B. Farrell on the fiddle.
The group says their music is bringing people across the country together in more ways than one.
The assumption that, oh, these country music white guys and these hip-hop black guys wouldn't find common ground. They wouldn't be doing things together. And I think that whole conception of who we are as a country is underpinning our politics in such a negative way. And that's what we are here to challenge.
That's Wrench. He's the guitarist and vocalist who brought the group Gangstagrass together because of his own love of vastly different genres of music. While it's not every day that we get to see a combination of these styles, genres, and people on one stage at one time, Wrench says that's the point of his group, and he hopes the country can take something from that.
If that's the assumption, oh, rural folks and urban folks can't have any common ground, or white folks and black folks don't have things that they can get into together, these are separate things, then how is any of our policy ideas going to include solutions that benefit everybody or that solve these things in a way that's communal instead of adversarial? You know, we're not here as a band to place any particular policy things. I don't think people in Make America Great Hats are going to show up and leave thinking about income redistribution, but there's a long game to this in terms of cultural work to challenge those assumptions and to just plant that seed of the idea that maybe those folks aren't the other. That's so separate. Maybe we're actually all on the same team.
Gangstagrass takes on issues ranging from mass incarceration to the pursuit of freedom in the modern day United States to everyday struggles. Our son, the voice of reason, says the unlikely combo challenges people to rethink their assumptions.
You are not who you are viewed as in most cases. And that's the thing that we find important about our shows is that, yeah, there are going to be people out here. There was a guy walking around here with an InfoWars t-shirt. I guarantee you that dude was out there bobbing his head. You know what I'm saying? And maybe he didn't hear everything, but this is the kind of stuff that it's very hard for you to walk away from because the sound is so infectious. And once you get into the sound, you're going to have to listen to it.
Brian Farrow, a fiddler and vocalist, says that at a minimum, the music is a conversation starter.
We're starting a conversation. Just by coming here, it doesn't need to be said. We get to be that example. And we get to start from a really good place in that conversation. And I hope we continue to have that conversation down the road. And I hope those folks that wear those hats feel free to come up to us after the show and just talk.
While challenging the injustice of the world is important, Dolio the Sleuth says it's equally important to know what we are fighting for.
Instead of thinking of it of us fighting against a thing, think of it of fighting for something. Because that energy goes a lot further. So if we go towards freedom instead of against the mass incarceration, then if you go towards justice or towards a more just society as opposed to fighting against specifically the injustice, what you have is a culture shift to where you have a momentum behind it. We got no time to be making new enemies when it comes to fighting for a just and free society and where humans can coexist in what semblance of harmony that we can have with the short amount of time that each one of us has on here, you know. And we want to make a world that is better for our children to inherit, you know, and we're not going to get that if we're too busy focusing on the anti. We want to fight for a just society. We ain't got time to be making new enemies. And as long as we give the momentum behind those who are working towards things that are good and just, the quote-unquote enemies have no choice but to acquiesce to the demands.
Dan Whitener says that while the health pandemic forced the group to think outside the box with producing their music, the events of last summer, including the tragic death of George Floyd, prompted the group to readjust their timeline.
Initially, like, we recorded the first three tracks in February in the studio together because that was fine, that was normal, that's what we were doing. And then we recorded the rest of the album in our own home studios, not to get, you know, isolated, and we tracked it and sent it to Wrench, and Wrench produced it, put it all together and made it sound amazing, because we were all in isolation and quarantine. So that was one way that we were responding to the times with that album. But another way was we had this song Freedom, and we had it all queued up. We were ready to think about releasing it. Maybe we were going to release some other, like, fun party track around June 19th. And then June 6th happened, and the protest movement around that grew. And, you know, it's powerful for us to be here because we're reminded that this is personal and local for the people that live here. But we felt it everywhere. And we were very aware of it, and we ended up moving our release stuff around, and we said, you know what, I feel like maybe Juneteenth this year, this feels like the right time to release the song Freedom.
I asked the group to tell me the backstory of their song, Freedom.
And I figured out we would make this song be a piece that would follow chronologically the struggle. Take it from, like, during active enslavement to, like, Jim Crow and civil rights, and then fast forward to some modern times where people are still facing the modern incarnation of the oppression and how people take their destinies into their own hands to take action to make freedom happen, because it's not about how people feel. It's about dismantling and restructuring things in a way that is more just for everyone, so that, you know, everyone in the country can actually experience the promise of freedom. It's like an article that was written into a contract that just has yet to be fulfilled. And it's up to us, as, you know, each generation, to move that marker forward to get it closer to what the actual promise of the word freedom is.
As you're talking about freedom, we hear fireworks in the background and people are celebrating freedom. And as you say, it's an aspiration, right? We've got this big mass incarceration problem. People don't feel very free, folks of color especially, right?
And they're not able to vote.
And a lot of them aren't able to vote if they're out. Even if they weren't felons, voting, enfranchisement, it's all tied together.
And that's not just U.S. citizens who are incarcerated. It's also affecting undocumented people of every age, you know, and when I say every age, I mean children as well. You know, outside of the music, we also are involved heavily in our communities and getting boots on the ground as far as activism is concerned. People who come to the country because of that hope that we put out there, the image that we portray, also gives others hope for a better life. And it's not as simple as saying, well, maybe they came here illegally. The thing is, like, if you think about the type of things that people are having to deal with in the places where they make the hard decision to leave everything they've ever been familiar with their entire lives to go to some place they've never been to, where they don't speak the language, where they know they're going to face adversity and opposition.
Dan Whitener and Wrench, the white men in the collective, wear button-down tops with cowboy hats. And Whitener sometimes has a flag emblazoned on his shirt. I asked him why.
I basically feel like the flag is, it goes back to that promise, right? It goes back to that expectation. And it means, that's what it means to me. And then I know that it also means a lot of things to different people, and it can represent some real tragedies, and it can represent all the atrocities, you know, committed by this land or the government or the military or whoever it is. Any flag waving civilian that says that they do things, you know, evil things in the name of the flag, it can represent that to people, and you're not wrong to see it that way. But for me, you know, I want to take that, and I want to take my, you know, skin color, appearance, what banjo, whatever it is about me, you know, if that can be looked at in a negative way, I want to take it back and sort of reappropriate, reclaim it, and put it into this context and say, if you see this, if you see me or this flag or whatever, you know, I want people to be able to see it in this better context.
The guides say that by showing up and being their authentic selves, they hope they're inspiring people and their audience to think more broadly. They describe their process of writing Never Coming Home, a song about mass incarceration.
I wrote a song when I joined the band called You Can Never Go Home Again, and it's just about, I was just writing it about like the experience of somebody going to prison, and that was it. I just wrote the, like, the, you know, lyrics and a chorus and stuff, and then brought it to the band, and then the MCs come in and they just bring like these completely different verses that, like, I wouldn't, you know, I know we don't like write for the MCs write their own verses, of course. And it's just not something I would have ever thought. It's not something I would have written. It's, you know, it's different voices coming together. And it's, in some ways, it's just so easy to do that, but it ends up being really powerful.
The story is about, as this guy is coming back from prison, one brother is telling the other brother, like, yo, this stuff you was getting into to begin with, they got you locked up in the first place, and now you're home, and, you know, here come the cops again, and the rest of us have to deal with your mess, sort of thing. And so it's from the standpoint of, you know, not only does this mass incarceration affect the incarcerated individual, but it affects everybody in their circle.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, because as a group, we tell a lot of stories, and we tell stories that we care about. Recidivism is a topic that means a lot to all of us, because in a lot of families in the country, mass incarceration is to the degree to where, like, you will be hard pressed to find a single family that has not been affected by it, you know. So when I heard our son's verse, I felt like it was the opportunity to tell the story from the perspective of the person who is coming out of prison, having a tough time adjusting to coming out. I mean, because this was a familiar story for people that I've known in my life. And then also the tragic end of it is the fact that the story ends with him not being able to cope fully with reentry into society, because they don't, you know, they no longer give people the coping mechanisms for reentry.
Gangsta Grass's manager, Sleeves, says she believes the band is playing an important role in reshaping the narrative of unity in the United States and beyond.
To be focusing on what we're fighting for and what we're trying to do, not what we're trying not to do. Because every positive interaction that people have with this band, every positive interaction that people have with this message and with each other at these shows is helping to reinforce the message. And the human rights and the bringing people together across differences to find that common ground.
The group isn't able to confirm whether or not they'll be appearing on America's Got Talent when the show resumes in August. However, they did say that you can learn more about their music by visiting www.gangstagrass.com. And the weather. In the San Francisco Bay Area, clear tonight with lows in the 60s, partly to mostly sunny tomorrow with highs between 70 and 80. In Fresno and the central San Joaquin Valley, mostly sunny tomorrow with highs in the hundreds. That's it for this evening's news. Thanks to Ann Garrison and David Rosenberg for helping to prepare tonight's news. Thanks to EA, who's at the controls, and to you, our listeners, for tuning in. I'm Sharon Sabota. Good evening.